I think I've said to many of you as I've been walking around and saying hello to friends, colleagues, people I trained with, current trainees, ex-trainees, what an interesting experience it's been for me preparing this particular lecture. Not only, as Malcolm has said, have I, in a way, got the presence of my first two trainers in the room, which, bear with me, if I fall into a sort of, oh gosh, I don't know anything, I think I'm slipping into a transferential process, so that may happen. But also, of course, I've chosen to talk to you about a topic called the liminal space, which will be exciting, but also is really about not knowing what's going to happen next. So as anybody who's written a dissertation or done an essay will know, parallel process tends to take over. So again, another reason that I might stumble my way through some of this is I think I might go into that whole personal process of being overexcited about what happens next and then think, okay, so what does happen next? So bear with me if that happens. But I want to say to many of you, just as I was stood here, a sentence from Marianne. And she would often, well, always, I think, start any meeting that I was in with a few words. And those words were, well, here we are. And it was really a way, I think, of her coming into herself. And somebody said to me today, being. You know, when you were with Marianne, you really were in the presence of somebody who, in her bones, had Gestalt. And I use the word had in a very different way than knew or taught Gestalt. She was Gestalt. She expressed Gestalt. She became Gestalt. And I, as a sort of rookie clinical psychologist at that time, used to look at her and think, well, how's she doing that? You know, what's the mechanism? How does it work? And what do you do? And of course, I would ask all these sorts of questions about, well, how did you do that? And what process happened then? And what did you do first? Which she would look at me, and another expression that, apart from my needs, that Marianne used to say to me was something like, typical. So there's going to be a whole sort of process that goes on here today, really, which is I'm going to try and talk in a way about what we do when we open ourselves to being. And the one thing that I've really learned over this 25, 26-year journey is that, of course, it looks like the being is simple. You know, it looks like you just turn up, sit down, say, well, here we are, and things happen. And, of course, you learn the hard way, and believe you me, I've learned the very hard way often. It's not like that. You know, there's some sort of magical process that goes on where it looks like you do nothing. It looks like there's an effortless flow. It looks like you're just having a chat and something other begins to happen. And my fascination really with Gestalt, first of all, was to see and experience this something other. You know, I didn't know what it was. I couldn't get my head around how it worked. But I did know, watching Marianne, watching Malcolm work, that they were doing or being something that I hadn't encountered before, but I had a longing. I don't know if most of you here can identify with that, but there was something that you think, oh, I don't know how it worked, but I know it works and I feel it working. What is that? What is that about? So, you know, I'm now thinking rather ambitiously. I thought I'd lecture and give a talk around that. And in a sense, what I've learned, what I've understood about that process. So, to start at the beginning, when I pitched up Gestalt Southwest, I think it's about 26 years ago now, I was full of a sort of linear logic, I think, which I knew two things. One was, there are very many situations easily identified where not only is it obvious that something needs to change, but it's pretty obvious what needs to change. Yeah, it's not a mystery often. what I couldn't understand was, given that I'd been through a complete clinical psychology training which analysed all of that, why it didn't just happen as simply as everybody told me it would. You know, you had 6 sessions, you'd done the analysis, you'd plotted the goals, you'd got the plan, or you'd done the strategy. But I seem to not be the only person that wasn't having massive success with just thinking, okay, you know, for example, you're anorexic. Problem, you're eating too little. Solution, eat more. You know, and this sort of complex technology had taken many of us in psychology quite a long time to learn. And I mean, there are clinical psychologists in the room, I know. And I don't wish to undermine the process that we went through, but at its most obvious, that was the change process. You know, you'd got a problem with alcohol or drugs. We've worked out that that's the problem. You know, again, stop using them. And I came to this conclusion, well, A, that's not working, and B, that actually it struck me through learning that process that we're actually, all of us, in considerably less control of our lives, of what we do, of our behaviour, of our thoughts and feelings, than we like to think we are. Alongside my Gestalt training, I've pursued various spiritual forms of practice, and I think many of them have led me to the conclusion rather rapidly that while my, call it my ego, my consciousness, has a clear understanding of many things in life, life is going on in the background in a very mysterious way. So, this really is the theme that we've got today. Linear change processes, which I've just outlined to you, compared to non-linear change processes. And I am going to be talking with particular reference to Gestalt theory, which may be obvious, may not be obvious. But for those of you who've come who aren't primarily Gestaltists, if I lapse into jargon, which I will try not to, but I may well do, that's the one time I would appreciate being interrupted and asked for a translation. So it's my intention to try and keep this in sort of language that we all understand. So I've explored this theme in a number of writings, teachings that I've done over the years, but perhaps most notably, I think I felt I sort of started to nail something important when I wrote a paper called Will and Grace. And I used the phrase will to refer to linear change processes, and also what I understood by then as linear forms of psychotherapy, of which certainly where I work, cognitive behavioral therapy, would be a linear therapy. There's a clear process to change and a clear sense of how it works. And I've used the phrase grace to refer to non-linear, to this magical, mysterious process where all sorts of odd things happen. And it is this grace end, or gracious end, that I'm going to be talking about in detail today, and that I think Marianne, in her teaching, enabled us to get a sense of. And I think it is one of those things that actually the learning process about this way of being, and in a sense working with the field from Malcolm, is something that we learn rather differently. We can hear it talked about, we can hear it explained, but actually we often have to see it and feel it to really get a sense of what it's about. I also want to say from the outset that I don't see will and grace as a polarity. So we're not talking about being in one or being in the other. I think every change process has different elements. All of you might have experienced situations or therapists who are trying to be in the grace end. And the way they do it is they turn up, they haven't prepared, they don't know what they're going to do. They might say things like, I'm going to go with the flow, or I'm just going to do it, or it'll just happen. Now, my experience of that is actually something happens, but it's not quite what we're talking about here. You know, that is the sort of lazy person's guide to psychotherapy, really. I think that we're talking about something very, very different, which is a sort of mastery of a way of being that is very, very complex. So, these two processes, will and grace, existing in dynamic tension. In 2005, I wrote about it in this way. Ultimately, however we define the creative synthesis of will and grace, I know it deeply and profoundly from my personal and clinical experience. It's the self-organization that, on a good day, gives me a life that flows and buzzes with impassioned vitality. The self-function that permits me to fully contact and connect with life. That creates the inspiration that lights up the therapy room in moments when I learn as much and sometimes more than my clients. It's then that I hear my own voice saying words that I haven't rehearsed or consciously thought, but they sound wise to me, both in what is said and also the how and the when of the saying. At these times, I've used my will and everything I've consciously learnt to get me to a place where I can let go. And the quality that I call grace intervenes. As the Hindu mystic Sri Ramakrishna stated, the winds of grace are always blowing, but you have to know how to raise the sail. So, this is what we're going to be talking about today. It's a process that I think Marianne understood well and that I think she would enjoy listening about. I want to acknowledge, however, that linear change is absolutely foundational as well in all we do. Gestalt theory holds itself somewhat outside a linear model. It has an emphasis on anarchy and what we call the paradoxical theory of change, which is the more you aim to change, the more resistance you encounter. But I would argue that, with the exception probably of mental health trainees, not many people enter a therapy process, a coaching process, an organizational development process with the aim of just exploring. You know, many of us will have done, but it's not common. So somewhere in the field that we enter when we work in any of these ways, there's an anticipation, a longing, an eagerness, and an expectation that something different and positive is going to happen. And I think to pretend that that's not around is naive. So, this synthesis at the moment between will and grace, I'm now talking about as an opening to liminal space. And on that note, I'm now going to try a bit more of the technology, the PowerPoint. I think it's another first for the Marianne Fry lecture. It's certainly something that Marianne would have raised an eyebrow and said, typical. And here we go. So, what is the liminal space? Well, many of you will be familiar with the notion of, or an etymology of the word liminal. It comes from the Latin, talking about threshold. And really classically, it's been used to describe a sense of being on the threshold of something that we know nothing about, but we know that something different is going to occur. So when you study this notion of liminality, you're really studying the place of transformation. Could be the place between death and rebirth. It could be the place where all normal structures break down. And there's certainly an opening to something new and unfamiliar. And what I'd like us to do is just begin to embody this in a slightly peculiar way. But if you're all willing, I'd like to encourage you to either stay seated, but probably standing up will give you a clearer idea. So if you stand up or turn round or do something different with your body or a part of your body that moves. And the more different, as I say, you might want to face the back, you might want to sit down, you might want to do anything, but just experiment. And what we're going to do is just begin to move a part of your body, might be your whole body, backwards and forwards, gently, in a sort of rhythmic motion, and begin to get a sense of that motion as you focus internally on your sensations. And I want you to become aware of your breathing and just try to pair breathing in with moving forward and breathing out with moving back. And just really pay attention to the breathing in as moving forward and the breathing out as moving back. Just let your body settle into that rhythm. As you breathe in, you move forward. As you breathe out, you move back. And as you move gently backwards and forwards, I want you to imagine standing on the threshold. This moment where you are anticipating moving forward into something new, but you are also pulling yourself back from action. Just notice how subtle this movement is. If you go forward too far, you lose your balance. If you go back too far, you fall back. So as you gently sort of experiment with being in this threshold moment, just allow yourself to remember times in your life when you've been on the threshold of change. Might be some important moments come to you. When life has opened in front of you with a call that you hadn't anticipated or known. And maybe your response was to step forward into the call, or maybe your response was to pull away from it. But just try and capture this moment when life's possibilities opened. And see how that feels in your body. Okay. What I would like you to do now is just take your seat again and just have a brief conversation, just literally 2 minutes with the person sat next to you about your embodied sense of that moment. So we haven't got time to take feedback, but I'm going to make probably a completely erroneous assumption about your experience of that. But one of the things that I noticed as I was preparing this is that I started off remembering big moments, you know, big moments in my life of sort of like, gosh, you know. But the more I did it, the more I realized that actually, of course, in every moment, we have exactly this experience. In every moment, we choose in our lives to go forward or to go back. And a lot of the time, as I was preparing this lecture, I realized how frequently I go back. So life sort of provides the opening, the call, and my response is, no, not today, I'm too busy. You know. And it was quite startling, shocking to me to even spend a day experimenting with saying, yes, I'll step forward. So by the end of the day, I had landed myself with all sorts of, you know, visitors, requests, opportunities, whatever. So it's very interesting how we manage these threshold moments and how rarely we observe them. So given that life has these wonderful, mysterious openings that come around all the time, why don't we take them? What happens? And I looked into, you know, the associations really with liminality, and we find that there are two main statements that we can think of as near enemies. The first is limbo, and that comes from the Latin limbus, and it means on the edge. And I guess most of you know that classically, limbo is the place that unbaptized souls go to. And they stay in some sort of permanent oblivion, really, a sort of vacuous state that they're trapped in. And I'm going to argue here today, or argue, put forward, suggest, that one of the things that in our society we've become very suspicious of is being in limbo. We don't like being stuck. We like action. We like to do things. Now, this may be very personal. I may be the only person who, you know, had that response to experiencing threshold moments as, no, go away, I'm too busy. But I think there is a sort of cultural fear of limbo and stuckness. It's gone out of fashion to stay still. So, also associated another near enemy, which not surprisingly I think turns up for the first time in the 70s, is this notion of a liminoid state, which is probably a response to the limbo state. Liminoid is where you're pushing forward, seeking the excitement, seeking the action, seeking the transformation, at a faster pace than life is actually delivering it. And Victor Turner writes about it really as often this is where people might use substances, you know, LSD classically, but other sort of psychotropic medications, alcohol, all sorts of ways to try and get into, I want transformation and I want it now. Yeah. And I think probably many of us who've been in the therapy field, and certainly the spiritual field, will know, you know, it's like on the spiritual superhighway is where I want to be. So if I meditate a bit more or do a bit more yoga or do a bit more. And really, I think this is what we would call a liminoid state. It's where our relationship with these threshold moments has become disturbed. And we've either pushed forward faster than life is really offering us an opportunity to do, or we've fallen back into limbo. And again, this afternoon, we'll have an opportunity to think, have we got a habit, because most of us have, of either pushing forward or falling back. So, just want to say a few things about the anthropological roots of liminality, and I'll press through this pretty quickly. But the first is around structure, and it's really looking at liminal space as a space where the dialectical tension between chaos and rigidity becomes loosened. So when I was thinking about this, I thought about trauma, and I'm sure many of you work with trauma now, both in terms of individuals but also organizations that are totally traumatized. And I think one of the ways we can think about trauma is that actually life pulls you over a threshold before you're ready to go. You know, you find yourself somewhere that you hadn't anticipated, and certainly the body hadn't been prepared for. And often our response to trauma, depending again on character style, our learning experiences, is either to rigidify, get very, very controlling indeed of what we will and won't do in order to stay safe, or to go into chaos, you know, to dissolve really and to fragment. So to stay in the liminal space is to manage the boundaries around structure. Liminal space is often also to do with time. Most of us know that when we have these magical moments that we're talking about, these gracious moments, normal sort of chronological time can disappear. Time becomes liquid and plastic and fluid. So it either speeds up, so you find that, you know, you've been doing something for 6 hours, but it seemed like 5 minutes. Or you've been doing something for 5 minutes and it seems like 6 hours. But the notion of time in liminal space also seems to be affected. And classically, anthropologically, it's related to equinoxes, times where you're between seasons, dawn and twilight, where you're between day and night. And also, those times, equinoxes, dawn, twilight zone, have often been used as an entry for the mysterious. They're an entering for spirits from other worlds, energies. You know, I mean, I'm not going into the twilight zone here, but if we think of the recent ceremony at Stonehenge, at the Druids, you know, classically in cultures, we've used different times that are liminal to support transformative processes. And we've really used ritualistic structures to signal those spaces. So generally, in a transformative process involving liminality, you look for ritual structure. And I think some of you that have worked with me, say in residentials particularly, will know that repetitive ritual structures are something that I believe deeply supports transformative change. There's something about as we do something again and again in a particular way, at particular times of day, as the body begins to know it, as we really pay attention, then things begin to happen that we couldn't have planned or consciously known. Alongside that, you get this change in states of consciousness where our perception may be deadened, you know, into a state maybe that approaches dissociation, but at best becomes very heightened. And it was interesting, Malcolm, when you were talking about Marianne, you used a word that I find difficult to say, but I think it was prescient, which is the slight sort of sense of being able to anticipate accurately what's going to happen next. And I think some writing that I'm doing at the moment on presence, when you're most present, I think all of us have that sense of, I knew you were going to say that. I knew that was going to happen. I knew that would be your story. You know, and this so-called sixth sense, or strongly intuitive way of being, becomes heightened. And when we're in that altered state of consciousness, then transformation becomes more likely. People, anthropologically, you can have people who in and of themselves are identified as more liminal than others. And often people who have these sort of special powers of presence or prescience will be people who are marginalized in some way. They operate on the margins of groups. They're people that you might call them seers, you might call them visionaries, you know, you might call them illegal immigrants, you might call them all sorts, you know. Again, they'll be positive and negative, but they are people who are extraordinary or outstanding in the way that they will stand out. There will be a quality of difference. Same with place, you know. Generally, there's a loosening of structure and an attachment to place that liminal space is more likely to be developed when we go somewhere specifically for the purpose of transformation, and the place, the situation itself supports that. So it might be somewhere that's on the edge between a sort of a town and the country. It might be somewhere that's marginalized in some way. It might be somewhere that has a particular feature like marshland or even an airport department or a crossroads. You'll all know that sense of standing at a crossroads or standing somewhere where people consistently come and go. You know, if you stand in the middle of a crossroads and look around you, there is that sense of possibility. So you look for a place that supports these sorts of change processes. And finally, I've written here about ethnographic research and therapy, which are these processes where you are both in a process and observing a process. And all of us really who work as gestalt therapists, this sense of self as instrument, know that we are both in and participating and also slightly marginalized and observing. So we're both in and of. And really, when you research the history of liminal space, you'll see these qualities of in-betweenness. So, I don't know about you, but often when I think about these things, I get a sort of sense of anxiety and a bit of excitement. And again, that sense that for me comes up in the meditation of, gosh, this is exciting. Why don't we do it then? And I suppose what I want to say is, this isn't the world we live in. And Marianne, for one, and many of us, I think, would say that increasingly, this way of being is not our world. This isn't the world we live in, where we go around sort of noticing liminal space, noticing time shifts, noticing place. We tend to focus more on our disconnection. And the individualistic paradigm, far from connecting us with these moments where we're deeply resonant, tends to distance us and to lead to that response of, excuse me, time, place, person, I'm too busy to attend to you. And certainly, as Malcolm says, in my day job, I can certainly recognize at the moment in the NHS, we've got this massive change process going on, and we're all running around at 100 miles an hour, looking for individual heroes to lead this process. With a sense, really, that how do we resource people? You know, at the moment in the coaching work I'm asked to do, how do I skill you up to lead this process? Or as the clinical lead, how do I get skilled up to lead this process, rather than a sense of somehow we've got to look to a much wider connection and relationship, that it's not within us to do this alone. But I think many factors, and I've just listed some of them here, conspire in a sense to give us a sense of disconnection. Capitalism in and of itself is very wedded to the idea of growth, you know, the hero, the growthful, the overcoming of the surroundings in order to resource yourself to be separate from and indeed over and above what surrounds you. Positivist science, I think, again, leads to us having a very reductive and dissociated view of things, where we break things into something that's replicable, that we can measure and that we can do again and again, and we can control. And of course, the very nature of liminality is that none of those things can we control. As I said when I started, the need for change is obvious. We can control it far less than we think. But most of our world tends to focus on growth and overcoming as a way of being. And that obviously has social and political repercussions for how people live. We tend to live in isolated units. We focus on nuclear families, we focus on individual teams, and at a systemic level, we focus on parts of systems. And that has big implications for the work we do, I think, in coaching, consulting, and therapy, where increasingly I find that what I'm asked to do is to join up, to rejoin, to integrate. I don't know if that's people's experience generally, but a lot of the work now that I look at is about the integrity of somebody's life. How do they reconcile different parts and bring them together? Organizationally, how do we get a whole systems approach? Coaching, how do I work with my team so that we support each other in doing this? And it seems to me that increasingly, our task really, perhaps in this community, is to hold a place in society where we're saying, actually, we don't have to do all of this on our own in this particular way. We can work together to do things. And as I said, that's not an easy place to hold. So, those of you who are Gestalt therapists, brace yourselves, because I'm going to just talk for a moment about a few of the taboos that we should no longer mention. But, of course, there is this emphasis of individualism right at the heart, really, of the theory. And, of course, Fritz Perls came into the Gestalt world, really, having been an analyst and got bored. I think is one way of thinking about it. Flight change takes so long. You know, how do you get things to happen? And came up with this classic Gestalt prayer, cover your ears. you know, of I'm me and you're you and I'm going to do my thing and you're going to do yours. And if by chance we meet, that's great. And if not, tough. And of course, what it did is mean that at the heart of many of our change models that were there in the origin of Gestalt, there's an emphasis on what we call the emerging figure. In other words, getting in touch with this arising need. And a tendency, I think, historically, to seize upon it like a vulture, you know, sort of pluck it out and say, what do you need now? Or, for me, what do I need now? And how am I going to aggress on the environment to get it? And, you know, I mean, you can probably tell from Marianne's early comments about no more of you and your needs. I think I took this on in a big way. And I got the idea that Gestalt psychotherapy is about finding out about my needs, really identifying them, stating them very clearly to as many people as would listen, and doing something about meeting them. And I thought that was being a good Gestaltist. So I think what we have in the contact cycle, which some of you know, well, many of you will know, actually encouraged that. And this wasn't something that was taught at Gestalt Southwest very often. But we nonetheless all got the idea that from the void, you know where we start in the void, sensations emerge, we bring them into our awareness, we mobilize. And at this point here between mobilization and action, which Perls called the classic neurotic block, really the job of the therapist or the facilitator is to somehow find a way to push somebody on around the cycle or to facilitate somebody around the cycle so that they have a completed cycle of experience. Now, this is a parody, but this is certainly what I think I somehow took from my early training. My job as the therapist or the facilitator was to come in between mobilization and action and free up the capacity to act. Now, I may have been the only person who got that message, but that was certainly what I got. And even quite recently, we find Lynn Jacobs writing about support as that which enables, with a sense of enabling somebody to act, to move into action in order to overcome, to rise to the challenge, to make contact. And I think this way of thinking about therapy generally, but Gestalt in particular, has led us to have some particular qualities that are deep within our world. And I've put here an agentic culture, an emphasis on action and agency, having the capacity to act. I've written about Gestalt as being a libidinous therapy, you know, an erotic therapy. We focus on this part of the cycle classically that's to do with energy rising. And certainly, you know, the bits probably that I loved most in my training were what I would call high contact moments, you know, where exciting things happened. And I think that, for me as well, led to an emphasis on the cathartic, the abreactive, the idea of strong emotional expression, my self-support. And all of that came into a sense of being autonomous, being authentic, and those two values being absolutely crucial, I think, when I started my early Gestalt training. And that I write about now as the will end of the dialectic. Now, this morning I have parodied that, and I think this is often in my teaching now. I call this the classic Gestalt style, the classic experimental style, because there are some things about this that are absolutely fantastic. It's very creative. People get very clear. We get very mobilized. We do things and feel supported in a way we haven't before. And I think there's been a tendency, I'm going to come on and talk about the relational turn. There's been a tendency recently to say, we don't do any of that. That's all in the past and all rather nasty. We're going to do something different. So I have to say, I suppose, that actually, I'm having done the relational turn, I'm doing a bit of a turn back and thinking, I think there's some things in here that probably we don't want to lose, that are the reasons that many of us have come into this sort of field, is to get an opportunity to do something for ourselves in a different way. So, as I say, there's been a paradigm shift over the past 15 years or so into what we call relational approaches, with much more a sense of connecting to the between of the dyad, the sense really that something's going on between us, but we can no longer be as sure as we were when we started that actually this is my stuff or you're just projecting. People remember those days? It was great, wasn't it? You know, as a therapist, there was only really one sentence you needed for the effective running of the whole therapy hour, which was, can you own that projection? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, you had to deal with this fact that we couldn't be so sure that this was my stuff or your stuff, and that what I had called a projection might be a perception. So that was very scary. And what I'm doing really now is focusing on the introduction of liminal space to expand this notion of the between to the between of the field. And this is something, Malcolm, obviously, that you've been pioneering, really, in your work throughout your career. And looking at our connection outside of the dyad, our connection, and not just to the group, but our connection with the whole field. You know, Gestalt is a holistic therapy. It's a holistic theory. And yet often, I think with the relational turn, we've come back to focusing just on the two people within the room. So, what's in a liminal model? Okay. A focus on context. What I mean by that really is, in any moment, there are a number of existential givens. Where we are, who we're with, what's going on around us. And all of our phenomenological roots ask us to pay attention to that. I mean, classically in Gestalt, we borrow from Husserl, who really came into phenomenology as a scientist, interested in saying, how do I take a scientific approach to understanding my experience of things? How can I be sure that this box of tissues, as I call it, is looking the same, and that Rod is thinking, this is a box of tissues too? And most of us in Gestalt got very familiar with what we call the phenomenological reductions that were designed to take us closer towards our pure experience of the tissue box. So we would just describe the tissues, we would horizontalize, and any feature that occurred to us we would think was as important as any other. And in particular, we would try and bracket everything we knew about the tissue box. It might not be a tissue box after all. But what we tried to do here is get closer to our experience. And that model really was taken up by Buber when he sort of first introduced this notion of how do we get closer to our experience of being with the other, and focusing on the space between when I meet each one of you. We begin to know and make contact with myself as I, and you as an it that I observe, as opposed to us sat here together as two people, having a meeting where something mysterious, and in Buber's terminology, God, fills that space. And there's a different type of contacting. I'm just going to list a few philosophers, and I know there's many people here who are much more versed in this stuff than I am, so bear with me. If I do something dreadful to Heidegger or any of your heroes, I apologize in advance. But one of the things that Heidegger did is said, let's forget this whole notion, really, of transcending. Let's forget the notion of bracketing. Let's forget any idea that we can be outside of ourselves and our context. We are always already in relationship. In other words, our connectedness, what I'm calling these graceful, gracious moments, are our natural state of being. That the sense that we have of being separate, of being disconnected, of being an I that can control something is secondary. Probably illusory, that life comes to us. We might turn away, you know? It's like, sorry, too busy. But actually, we're always and already in our context. This is taken up with Merleau-Ponty, who took up this theme really in relation to, and the way we are always and already in contact is because we are embodied. Inconvenient. You know, we get tired, we have to eat, we have to do all sorts of things that many of us would rather not do. We'd just like to be a mind at times. But the world I find myself in is an embodied world. Everything comes to me through and as part of my body. I can't tell. I like to think I can, but I can't tell quite where I start and the world begins. Where do we finish? Where's the boundary? And we have all sorts of ways we think it's at the skin, but experience would tell us it probably isn't. You know, those of us who've, if you've worked with people who've lost a limb in an accident, you know that the sense of having the limb is ongoing. If you've ever lost a lot of weight, you will know that the sense of being the size you were continues. You know, you sit down, and you think, oh, there's the, oh, what happened? So we actually space occupy in a way that is larger than our skin. And in that space, what is me and what is you and what is the context becomes, I would say, liminal space. It's not as obvious or clear as we like to think. In terms of language, Hans-Georg Gadamer had his notion of philosophical hermeneutics, really, which is that we like to think that we know what we're going to say. It's like planning a lecture. One of the things I could have done is turn up and read to you, and that would have ensured that I did know what I was going to say. But actually, it makes it really difficult for me to be here with you in this moment. And although I'm talking and you're listening, your listening and looking is incredibly supportive of my talking. And I'm very, very aware of little nods or who might be going to sleep at the back and all this, you know. So we are in an intimate relationship in this moment that we could not be in if I had prepared any more than this, I believe. And what Gadamer said is that for true speech, true dialogue, there is always the interaction between what I'm throwing out to you and what you're receiving from me. And one way of thinking about this is that I have an intention to meet you in a particular way that I most commonly do through my language, through my words. However, somewhere in it being passed to you, you hear something slightly different from what I thought I said, which when I hear you say it, I realize wasn't what I meant to say at any rate. Now, therapy really is a process of those understandings going backwards and forwards the whole time and discovering in the moment what it is that we want to express. I don't know about most of you, but I certainly came into therapy thinking that it was about telling somebody my narrative that I already knew. And that somehow that would be the healing bit. And I think to a small extent that is true. But actually the transformative bit is when I start saying things to you that I didn't know I was going to say. And then I hear from you something that I wished I had said, thought I was going to say, but actually you said it instead of me. And that somehow in the between, this incredible transformative process begins to occur. So certainly in Gadamer, we get the difference, clearly articulated for the first time, of the difference between intention, what I intend to put out, and the impact that I might have. And I suppose one of the things I want to say about will and grace is that will is a lot about attending to my intention. Grace and the relational turn is a lot about attending to impact. And I think for a transformative process, we need to attend to both. Because my experience at some stages is, okay, I can go too far into this is what I want to do and now I'm going to do it. But I can also go too far into how are you feeling and doing? And I am here merely to respond and I lose myself. So actually we're asked to inhabit this very, very difficult place of knowing our intentions and assessing our impact in the moment. It seems to me that in that where we have the between of the dyad and the between of the field coming together, that is the liminal space. Philosopher and this large body of work that I think has been missing really from most of our Gestalt sort of discourse so far is Alfred North Whitehead on process relational philosophy, which seems to be a sort of natural bedfellow really. And those of you who know this work, I hope might agree. But really, process relational philosophy tends to say that we are all made up of these moments of experience and nothing more. And that right down at the heart of everything that we know, you know, be it a rock or a table or something, is the same stuff, but organized very, very differently. And this idea, those of you who've read Philip Pullman might know this idea of the stuff. But it's a lovely word that Alfred North Whitehead brings into process relational philosophy of concrescence, which is that the organization of stuff into Sally or Curtie or Malcolm or Mike, that's how we form what Whitehead calls societies. And so I'm a society of stuff and you're another society, but actually we're all the same stuff. And when we have these transformative experiences, there are often experiences where we realize profoundly that we're all much more similar than we are different. And of course, modern neuroscience increasingly begins to tell us that from the very beginning, the infant and the caregiver, there's this moment of confluence, we would call it in Gestalt, connection, and what in cognitive neuroscience, I think, I refer to as a sort of naked intentionality. In other words, we each have our own individual intentionality, what we want to do, what we want to say. But very early developmentally, it would seem that the infant has an idea that, well, something's going on around here, but I'm not very clear who's doing it. And that part of our individuation is we begin to have this sense of agency. So that if I raise my right arm, I know that Malcolm's not raising his. But at the moment, when I'm very young, all I know is, well, somebody's doing something. You know. So this separation is the move away from our natural state. Our natural way of being is to be much more connected. This has picked up, those of you who've read Daniel Stern's recent work on vitality signs will know that increasingly we know now that not just through the mirror neurons that give us some ideas about, I can guess what you're feeling through my sense of your gesture. Increasingly, there's a whole content message that's carried in the body. Stern writes about what he calls the dynamic pentad of movement, intentionality, time, space, and force as the five sort of signs that actually affect how we experience somebody's presence. And that we don't just get a feeling of interpreting the gesture, we get a sense of content that comes through as well. And so it's quite exciting work, used a lot in the dramatic and performing arts, as to how would you most convey particular expressions and ways of being, and studying the content messages that we appear to be very, very accurate in picking up. So all of these, I think, are factors that I put into the gracious end of this dynamic, the place where our being and also our becoming have this sense of intimate relationship between ourselves and between the situation. And that leads to a few action practices for living more graciously that I'm going to run through with you, because time is getting short and we haven't really got time for many of these. However, to focus on an increasing awareness of our embodied relational beingness. And really, in writing that I've done about presence with Marianne Shidiak, we point to this factor of resonance. When we're most present, we get a sense of resonating with and for the others in the room. I mean, really, that's no more than saying that classic old actor's line, you know, feel your audience. Because you can. You can feel and resonate too. And probably in different body parts. I mean, I know for me, resonance is something that I get down here. You know, I'm not going to even have a guess at where many of you might get that. But that idea of being with in a kinesthetically attuned way. Staying mindful of the current context. Mindfulness increasingly coming into psychotherapy. For those of us in Gestalt, it's very similar to our daily practice of awareness. But I know, and I'm sure most of you do, that many things in life take me away from that. So as a daily discipline, checking body, checking mindfulness. Getting used to appraising those multiplicity of options in any situation. As I said, be aware in every moment there are many, many choices occurring. And to go away and have an action practice of just attending more to choices and options. As you attend to options, focusing on your phenomenological indicators of mobilization and excitement. In other words, resonate with yourself. What do you notice? You stand at the crossroads. You stand on the threshold. What do you notice as you begin to attend to these moments? Do you feel the call forward? Do you feel the fall back? And how much of that is habit? Containing action. Many of us have habitually got used to having to do many more things than we were designed to do in a day. Practicing not acting, I find, is a real discipline. Not answering the phone, not answering the email, not coming out of the office when somebody needs to talk to me. We're getting increasingly wired to respond, but of course the calls to respond now are huge. So practicing containing action, staying on the threshold and noticing. Experimenting with very small first steps, you know, in terms of resourcing ourselves for action. Before we do the dive and say, yeah, I'm going that way, what is needed in terms of starting down that road? And as I start, what happens if I come back? So often there's a sense of, oh, I've made the decision, I've committed now, I'm going to do it. But actually, what happens if I don't do it? What happens if I come back? How does it feel now? Then I'll try a bit more and come back, checking my resource base. Reflecting on impact. So I'm staying aware of my intention, but I'm also noticing, in true Gadamer-esque style, what changes as I act? What happened then? Trying not to go too far before I pay attention to that end. and then committing to engagement with the unfolding process. For those of you who've studied dialogue, which I know is most of you, this is a natural part of what we do. We commit to staying with the process. Actually, what I find can happen is that we lose ourselves in that process. So hence the need to come back into the very first sort of premise, staying with your embodied resonance, yourself and the other. Reviewing, rehearsing, reflecting. So what does this look like if we reformulate the Gestalt cycle from it? Instead of arising from a void, we arise from our context. Every situation has its own subjectivity. Ty Francis, who some of you will know, is a well-known constellator in terms of constellations work. And he and I have put together some ideas about every situation having its own subjectivity. We tend to think of only people having subjectivity. But actually places have atmospheres, they have qualities, they have properties, and we tend to attune to those. We notice the sensation, awareness, and mobilization. Some of us might find that mobilization has become a bit aversive, and that what we tend to do is classically reverse and go into limbo. So when we feel the mobilization, rather than being able to hold it, we reverse and come back. And in this model, what I'm proposing is that instead of that, we would stay with inaction at the point of mobilization, and then have all sort of minor iterations where we go round that point again and again. So using the practices I just described, paying attention to our embodied relational being, focusing on our awareness, taking first steps, and that really support then would be that which accompanies the person. It's not that which enables. It's much more sitting alongside in these processes where it feels that we're just going again and again over the same ground. But what we're actually trying to do is stay with this heightened awareness without falling back into a limbo state, but also without going into a liminoid sort of manic, overexcited, yes, I'm doing everything, you know, I'm going to yoga and I'm meditating and I'm... So not sort of, in a sense, going out on that limb either. In order, in a way, that the field catches up with us and that things begin to change in harmony. And so the action that comes, it's what I would call field relational action. It emerges from the moment. So it's not that we have to instigate a change process, but it's that we are embraced by the situation and that our timing and the situation move together. And I think when we've had those moments, those magical, effortless, easy moments where things just happen, that's what we're seeing just happen. So when I wrote this, I felt very, very blessed indeed that I'd been able to train with people who had a strong sense of that. So thank you, Malcolm. Thank you, Marianne. And thank you, the people who were with me in my training. Because I think we did get a sense of what it means to be in that moment, which is to be inspired. In the sense of being in spirit, we actually feel lifted. So, just moving along, I think there's some things I want to say by way of ending that are implications for Gestalt theory and praxis. But we're talking about synthesizing classic Gestalt and the relational Gestalt, or will and grace, into what I would call a liminal model. So having trained in one and trained in another, beginning to pick up the two and use them together. Focusing more on structures of ground. Some of you know I'm in peer supervision with Peter Phillipson, who whenever he hears this expression, sort of, yeah. As soon as you've got a structure of ground, it becomes figure. However, in the moment before it becomes figure, it's that which is under and underneath us. It's our context from which we emerge. And we're talking here about that moment of transcendence and immanence joined, being and becoming, They're very fleeting, and of course, in every moment as we spot it, it's already past. But we can have the embodied sense of arising, and we arise from our context. I think this will lead to us paying attention to the paradoxical theory of change in a slightly different way, attending to that sense of deep relationship with what is going on in the moment. We've always had the idea of just stay with, but it was never clear to me what I should stay with. Was it me? Was it you? Was it what was happening? Was it the figure? Was it? But I think what we mean now is these real micro moments. Again, Daniel Stern writes about them very well in Vitality Science and the present moment, of really staying with very fine discriminations and inhibiting action. Obviously, Gestalt has become much more interested in assessing impact as well as intention, and knowing that I can never know my impact unless I'm in dialogue and connection with things, people around me. Most of us go through life trying to blunt that because the impact of our actions can be very painful to see. An openness to being affected. Very hard to inhabit the liminal space unless you've got an openness to, I've called it resonance, but to feeling the impact of the situation that you're in. That means you will be changed. I think those of you who I spoke to as you were coming in today, what was interesting is I felt the connection in so many different ways. How each of you had impacted me in different ways in my life. And that might be, I know one person I spoke to, piece of work that we did together 15 years ago. Another person, training we did together 25 plus, you know, exams we did together 20 something. Each of us has impacted and had these connections over time. And actually, we only know them if we've been in that moment with that person and affected by them. Support is that which accompanies. You know, I often describe it as riding pillion. You want to be right up close. It's throwing your weight around, really, and you feel it through the body. You know, you feel it, the resonance comes through the body, not through the thinking. The thinking is often too slow. Obviously, we are emerging together. We know that at the heart of our theory. We know we're looking at responsiveness. We're looking at a change process. But as a constantly emergent connection with a dynamic, interconnected universe. So that's what we're thinking about in terms of this synthesis of will and grace, and therapy, coaching, consulting as an accompaniment of something that's already happening if we catch the wave. It's not something we have to make happen, it's something that is happening. It's those moments that are opening that we're going to fall into. So, just a summary. Sometimes when I'm teaching, I think we overemphasize a particular skill set to do with mobilization and working with change. I think there's a whole other skill set that we need to be teaching, which is about containment, about stopping action, about staying still, about allowing the body to rest, about doing things together that look like just hanging out, and that are about being rather than doing. That skill set has not been well articulated, and yet most of us know we do it. It's not as spectacular, but I think there is a need to think, what exactly am I doing when I'm doing what we call containment? I've described it much more as accompaniment. You know, this embodied staying up close, waiting to respond with mindfulness. And I think the findings from recent neuroscience are going to give us a whole bank of information to draw on. And in particular, we're talking here about studying impact. As we make changes, what changes around us, and how do we then calibrate in response? What I'm going to do now is I'm going to read you a story. I've been talking, but you can now relax back down, if I can find it. And it's a story told by a woman called Claire. And second name is Torrey. And she tells this story to a publication called Brain Damage. So, relax. We're going to be about 5-10 minutes in this phase, and then we're going to have time for some questions. So, here's the interview. I'm the interviewer. You got the call on a Sunday, apparently. Yeah. I was rung up by a chap called Dennis, who worked at Abbey Road. He was the accountant, really. Anyway, he'd been told to get in touch with me. He asked me to come into the session, sounded a bit desperate, and said, well, can you do it like now? I said, no. He said, well, what about tomorrow? Well, I couldn't do that either. I said, the only possible time I can come is next week. And he said, oh, no, they're busy mixing by then. They were right at the end of the record. I said, well, if you're desperate, the only time I can possibly do it is tonight, 7 till 10. Obviously, she went, because his next question is, what were your first impressions of the band? Well, they didn't say very much. I went in, and they just said, well, we're making this album. There's this track. We really don't know what to do with it. They told me what the album was about. It was about birth and death and everything in between. So I said, well, play me the track. They did that, and I said, well, what do you want? They said, we don't know. Remember, I was pretty green. I'd been working for a while. I'd recorded my own songs, but I was new to it all. So I just listened to the track. In the end, I said, well, let me go into the studio, put some headphones on, I'll have a go. I went in, put the headphones on, and just started going, ooh, and ah. And all this time, I was getting a bit more familiar with the backing track. There was a bit more conflab. I remember thinking to myself, I really, really don't know what to do. Perhaps it would just be better if I said thank you very much and gave up. We weren't getting anywhere. It's just nothing. That was when I thought, well, maybe I'll pretend I'm an instrument. So I said, start the track again. I started getting a pattern of notes. And they said, well, this seems the right direction to go. I told them to put the tape on. I knew from past experience, well, I was called First Take Torrey, because very often the first take I ever did was the best. At the end of the first take, Dave Gilmore said to me, do another one. Just try and get into the emotion. So I did another one. And then he said, I think we could do a better one. I started, but halfway through I realized I was going to be repetitive. It was getting derivative. It didn't have that off-the-top, instantaneous something. It was beginning to sound contrived. I said, I think you've got more than enough. I went away. I thought it sounded like caterwauling. I think Rick Wright has subsequently said I was embarrassed. And I was. I just went away and thought, oh dear. But I actually said to them, thank you very much. And off I went. By 10 o'clock, I was having dinner with my boyfriend in the Chelsea kitchen on the King's Road. So, if we can, Tony, listen to the track.